Welcome to Twice Blessed, a Yeshiva University Strauss Center podcast exploring Torah and Western thought. I'm your host, Shayna Trepido, and this season we're examining Shakespeare and the Hebrew Bible. It is a joy and privilege to speak with Rabbi Dr. Ari Berman today. In 2017, President Berman was elected Yeshiva University's fifth president in its 135-year history. To borrow words from George Washington, I imagine that at the time, President Berman accepted the mantle of leadership he anticipated with pleasing expectation, not only the happy rewards of the charge, but the cares and labors that came with it. But I doubt anyone anticipated the challenges that the global pandemic put upon educational leaders in this past year. To have President Berman enlighten us about the crisis of leadership in Hamlet, about finding ways to move forward when time is out of joint or asynchronous, about being called to set right situations not of our own making, Dayenu, it would be enough. But he's also here as a distinguished thinker and scholar. As an undergraduate at Yeshiva College, President Berman majored in philosophy. He received his master's in medieval Jewish philosophy from the Bernard Revel School of Jewish Studies, completed his rabbinical ordination from YU's Theological Seminary Reeds, and he received his PhD in Jewish thought at Hebrew University. In his numerous public lectures and articles, President Berman draws from a broad range of distinguished experiences in the worlds of higher education and Jewish communal life. I am so grateful that he has made time for us today on his Google Calendar, the sight of which I imagine might harrow my soul and freeze my blood, as the ghost tells Hamlet when he refuses to speak of his experiences in the beyond. President Berman, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Shayna. It is wonderful to be here and wonderful to hear and be with you in this such an important podcast. That what you're doing for Yeshiva University, for our community, for the broader Jewish and the broader academic world, with your incredible work. We're so excited that you're here and how you elevate us. And it's just a thrill and privilege to be here with you.
Thank you so much. It's an inspiring place to be at a time like no other. So before we get into the play itself, though, I'm really curious. You're a graduate of four Yeshiva University institutions, including MTI High School. What was your first encounter with Shakespeare within a Jewish educational setting, or perhaps what was your favorite encounter?
Sure. I would say my first one was probably in some high school literature class where Shakespeare was required reading, and I did not enjoy it. That would be my, if I have some memory of that time, it would be that. But my enormous respect and fondness and really appreciation for Shakespeare developed in the course of my lifetime. I'm a lifelong reader. I see education not as limited to a period and a stage in a person's life. And Shakespeare is something that came later for me. And Hamlet, certainly, my favorite play, and Shakespeare, my favorite playwright. And I felt incredibly enriched by the experience.
So I understand that you've also been on the other side of the desk or lectern, that you've taught courses, actually, that involve Hamlet. So I ask, I guess, as an educator, particularly within a Yeshiva University setting, what's important to you when it comes to teaching a text like Hamlet? What are your objectives? What do you want your students to be attuned to?
Yeah, no, it's a great question for educators like yourself and the incredible educators in our university and community. I had the blessing when I was the rabbi of the Jewish Center to teach a Shakespeare in the Bible course. I had many semesters on Shakespeare in the Bible, not just Hamlet. And what we did is we compared and contrast Shakespeare's stories with the great biblical stories. The themes, the human experiences that emerge in Shakespeare's writing often complement, sometimes contrast, and differ with very similar and parallel stories from our own Torah tradition. And what I used to do is at the Jewish Center in We had about 100 people, maybe more, come, you know, once a week. We had some people who volunteered to choose to play the roles. I had them acting it out. And then we'd read a parallel Torah story and flesh out, you know, where the similarities and where the differences, which is so important, not just to understand Shakespeare, to understand our own lives, but to understand the tradition and the Torah in which, you know, we draw our sustenance.
I mean, Hamlet is not the first play that people think of when they think of Shakespeare in the Bible, right? We're going to go to Merchant of Venice, Job and Lear. But this, as you say, the stories, right, the narratives of the Torah really do saturate this play. Is there a particular story that you felt really enhanced your reading of the play, or vice versa, enhanced your reading of Shakespeare?
Yeah, well, first, the whole theme, meaning not even focusing on a specific scene yet, but the whole theme of, you know, King Claudius killing his brother and assuming the royal throne and the queen and marrying the queen. I mean, that's that is the human issues of jealousy and rivalry, certainly when it comes to sibling jealousy and sibling rivalry, dates back to the beginning of Bereishis and the beginning of the Torah. This is Cain and Abel. In fact, the rabbis say in the Medrash that they ask, what were Cain and Abel arguing about when they were in the field when Cain killed Abel? And there are different opinions that emerge. One is that they are arguing over power. Who's in control of the world? There are only two people. Who's in control? The other is that they were arguing over the one woman who was on the world, whether it was Chava, could be, or it could be a twin that was born to one of them. And the third is that they were arguing about religion, that they divided the lands between them, but they were arguing where would a temple to God stand? Would it stand in Cain's land or Hevel's land? And these are the major themes that we know throughout antiquity until today, you know, from Helen and Troy and on, of people fighting over the queen, or over lands and power, or over God and religion. And, you know, so the whole sibling rivalry that is behind the scenes in Hamlet, you know, is fleshed out all through Bereishis, from Cain and Abel into almost, you know, almost every generation afterwards. You know, when it comes to Yishmael and Yitzchak, Isaac and Ishmael, or Jacob and Esau, and Yaakov and Esau, and Joseph and his brothers. You know, these are the themes of sibling rivalry. So how it plays out in Hamlet in contrast to how it plays out in Bereishis. And the whole idea of a son feeling the need to avenge his father by killing his uncle. Or, you know, these are all part of the stories of Bereishis.
I wonder if you could say more about how it plays out, because one of the things that, you know, in bringing these two different, I guess, approaches to similar conflicts or human urges, desires, they end very differently. Shakespeare ends with a tragedy, you know, a pile of bodies at the end of the story. And I would venture that the Torah doesn't quite end in the same way.
Does not end that way, and I think that's crucial. I think that's a crucial element. You know, in these very famous classic stories of sons avenging fathers or fathers sacrificing sons, these are all part of the same dynamic. You know, honor codes and what expectations are. So you see, I mean, Shakespeare already takes it a step further just by Hamlet reflecting and meditating and thinking, you know, is he going to play that role and be that avenging son and fit into that canon and that body of expectation of an honor society or not, you know, which really runs throughout this question that runs throughout the play. You know, what is he to Hecuba, Hecuba to he, and saying that he has, that's just actors with emotion. Imagine if they were in his situation when he has real cause to act.
Oh, what a rogue and peasant. peasant slave am I? Is it not monstrous that this player here, but in a fiction, in a dream of passion, could force his soul so to his whole conceit that from her working all his visage wand, tears in his eyes, distraction in his aspect, a broken voice, and his whole function suiting with forms to his conceit, and all for nothing? A Hecuba? What's Hecuba to him, or he to Hecuba, that he should weep for her? What would he do had he the motive and the cue for passion that I have?
This kind of meditation on society's expectations of him. Shakespeare's, evolution of the story, is very profound. For us, looking back in the Torah stories, we have a whole, a whole other tradition of evolution of how this plays out. From Cain and Hebel of siblings fighting each other, on the one hand, going through the Torah and concluding with Joseph and his brothers, you see a very different conclusion. It's Jacob blessing all of his sons, and working to bring all of his sons under the tent and into the fold. And it's after Jacob passing away, it's the brothers coming to Joseph and saying, our father told us before he died, he asked us to ask you to forgive us. And by Daber Alibam, and then Joseph speaks to their hearts. And he says, it's not in my power, meaning it was God. God was behind our lives. And, there's nechama, and there's comfort and a recognition of higher authority and resolution and reconnection. And rather than a pile of dead bodies, there's a family that is able to emerge united. And from that family became a nation. So how the Torah treats this, the classic, not just stories, but the human characteristics that create tension. And how Shakespeare does, I think, is important in this case, in the contrast. Mm-hmm. I think you're right to focus on the ending.
So, I mean, in contrast, or maybe more appropriately in complement to what you just brought up, that so much of the Torah in moving forward in futurity is about speaking to your son, speaking to the next generation. I see maybe some valences of that at the end of the play too, where Hamlet charges Horatio to tell my story, but Horatio's not equipped. He only knows what he saw. He doesn't know what happened inside of Hamlet's mind. So he can only tell kind of a truncated version of that story, which is why perhaps the rest is silence for us.
Yeah, and the end of that, meaning as Hamlet says, who tell my story? Who's the hero of the end of the story? Is it Hamlet? Is he the hero? Is Fortinbras the hero? Where's that itself, that whole meditation on, are we who we think, or are we how we act? Very profound and very important. Fortinbras did avenge his father's loss and was a man of action, a prince who took the sword and fought the battles. And as we know from the beginning of the story, Fortinbras' father lost his land to Hamlet's father and now comes back at the end and reclaims the land and more. So who's the hero? And I do think that, in this case, Shakespeare's point of, tell my story, it's not just Horatio. I mean, Shakespeare is telling the story. The story lives on. That itself, if it's a compliment, we're a people of stories. The people of the book, we're a people of stories. And we understand the importance of foundational stories. And it's not just in that case in enriching our understanding of human experience, but it goes to our identity. Like who we are as people is locked into our heritage and our past. The stories that we tell about ourselves is part of who we are. I'll share with you an experience that just happened to me. I was just with my father and my daughter. And my father told my daughter the story about how his father passed away. His father was in a coma, was in the hospital, and his heart stopped beating, and then it started again, and it was going on and off, stopping and starting. And my grandmother turned to my father and said, "He's not going to leave until you recite Tehillim for him." And my father recited a psalm. And the minute he finished, my grandfather's heart stopped and it never started again. And, it was a story that I've known and that I've heard before. But having my father tell it to my daughter about his father, and knowing that my daughter, Bezrat Hashem, please God, will have the opportunity to tell it to her children and her grandchildren, is an example of how a story will live on for over 100 years, 4 or 5 generations. And everyone in that story will know the names of everybody else in that story. The connection of the Mesorah passing down our stories to our children. And that's foundational. That's identity. You know, so our stories, when we speak in the Seder about, you know, Abraham and onwards, we're not talking about the patriarchs. We're talking about our fathers and our mothers. It's not patriarchs and matriarchs. It's fathers and mothers. And that tells the story that Shakespeare says at the end. I mean, he understands the importance of stories. And that's our tradition. We're storytellers. And it's core to who we are.
Thank you so much for sharing that story with us. I you know, Hamlet, or Claudius really tells Hamlet that, you know, the death of thought fathers is the theme and is a common theme of life, but not as eloquently as you've illustrated it for us here.
Right. Claudius is like, get over it. Right. That's a great point. Claudius is to Hamlet, get over it. Right. Like, fathers die. Move on.
He's truncating the storytelling in a sense.
That's a great point.
'Tis sweet and commendable in your nature, Hamlet, to give these mourning duties to your father. But you must know your father lost a father. That father lost his. And the survivor bound in filial obligation for some term to do obsequious sorrow, but to persevere in obstinate condolement is a course of impious stubbornness. 'Tis unmanly grief.
You mentioned Hecuba and Hamlet kind of having to live up to an honor code. So in the critical history of the play, some people have suggested, you know, many worthy scholars have suggested that, you know, Hamlet, if he were in a Greek play, there'd be no question, right? You killed my father, I kill you, the end. Hamlet's problem is that he is a religious being, right? That he believes in a soul. And that is the conflict. So, you know, in this critical reception of the play, we have to put a little bit in context. It's the 16th century. It's post-Reformation Protestant England. It's set in a medieval time period in Denmark. But really the play and the way it's been received sets up this dichotomy, right? There's the antiquated worldview. And then there's Hamlet, the first modern man, right? The invention of modern man, you know, as Harold Bloom gives us. Do you see religion or this antiquated religion as a dichotomy to kind of modernity and Hamlet's skepticism and secularism? Are those the two things in as much conflict for you in this play, or just, do you buy into that, I guess?
Sure. There's so many layers to this question. It's a great question. I would start thinking about this question. Also going back to the Torah and really contrasting the Greeks versus our biblical tradition and the idea of honor killings and the evolution of honor killings and, you know, the shift from vengeance to justice. You know, in the Greek tragedies, you see it in Aeschylus and, you know, the whole shift of the Furies to the Eumenides, and you know, the Orestian trilogy, where Orestes kills his mother Clytemnestra for killing Agamemnon, and then the Furies insisting on vengeance, and then instead Athena calls the trial, you know, which is seen as the shift to justice and to trial by jury. And, you know, in the Torah, we have that. It's so foundational to us, you know, going back to killing somebody by accident. And the Torah is saying, you know, we don't allow, you know, the family member has a right, but we're going to give an escape hatch. We're going to give safety, you know, and we have judges, and there's din, you know, and there's adim, and there's witnesses, you know, and it's shifting a whole societal notion of taking matters into one's own hands. To justice, to tzedek tirdof. So I definitely see, you know, already, again, there are parallels in different traditions, but you already see the beginnings of that. You see the Torah addressing that. The other piece of Hamlet as a modern man isn't that he has a conscience. I think it's that he's aware of his conscience. It's the experience of his conscience. And he's able to unpack his heart in words, as even though he says it self-critically at that time, but he's able to unpack his heart in words. And that sense of interiority is something actually we don't have in Bereishis. We don't have that. You know, the stories of the biblical stories, you know, the Torah, are very externalized. It's their stories that happen. You see the action, and you try to think about, you know, what are the people thinking as they go, what's their experience of it? But it's not, it's rarely said, even an emotion. Sometimes emotions are said, you know, happiness and sadness or anger, but you're not brought into that experience. You know, you understand what it's like. You could see Yaakov competing with Esav for the love of his father and for the blessings, but we're not shown what did Jacob feel when he was competing with his brother for the love of his father. I think actually the rabbis, often in the Midrashic literature, bring us into the interior of the person. Whether it's conversation about Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Hara, different inclinations in people. I mean, there's a much greater fleshing out of the experience of being alive, you know, in different challenges or opportunities of life and love and threats and jealousies and, you know, so it's more interior, but we have nothing like in rabbinic literature like Hamlet and the way that Shakespeare can unpack the heart in words and really, you know, flesh out for us the experience of being human. And you have it, of course, in Job, and you have it in other stories in the later, you know, in the Ksuvim, meaning it's not only the rabbis, but that you don't have it in the Torah. You know, it comes afterwards, and then certainly in the Midrashic, right. The Talmudic tradition, yeah.
Right. Certainly comes after. I mean, I think where perhaps if, you know, Shakespeare was an avid reader of the Bible, where he probably, I assume, located it was in Psalms, right? As you mentioned, there's something just right. About Psalms that brings
a great
it
point.
To your personal experience. I think it was William Hazlitt that said, like, Hamlet is all of us. We always read ourselves into Hamlet, you know, in the same way, not exactly the same way, but in the same way that when we approach a text or we approach words from the heart, they really do enter the heart. So I wonder if you could maybe tell us a little bit, you said about, you know, these are the experience of mankind, the conflicts that we deal with, you know, then and now a lot of these things follow through. Another aspect of Hamlet that maybe you're uniquely poised to help us with is there are so many bits of advice that are given very critically. Like we look at Polonius, and he gives advice to his son, who's, you know, kind of studying abroad.
My blessing with thee, and these few precepts in thy memory, see thou character. Give thy thoughts no tongue, nor any unproportioned thought his act. Be thou familiar, but by no means vulgar. Those friends thou hast and their adoption tried, grapple unto thy soul with hoops of steel. But do not dull thy palm with entertainment of each new-hatched, unfledged comrade. Beware of entrance to a quarrel. But being in, bear it that the opposed may beware of thee. Give every man thy ear, but few thy voice. Take each man's censure, but reserve thy judgment. Costly thy habit as thy purse can buy, but not expressed in fancy, rich, not gaudy, for the apparel oft proclaims the man. Neither a borrower nor a lender be, for loan
oft loses both itself and friend.
And borrowing
of husbandry.
This above all, to thine own self be true. And it must follow as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man.
What would you perhaps say, you know, drawing on your experience in academic leadership and scholarship, your advice for students today? I mean, David Scott Caston says that for Shakespeare, the whole thing is uncertainty, right? That's the thing in Shakespeare. So in these very uncertain times, advice you'd give to college students or maybe to yourself, if you could go back and your own journey.
Sure. Now, of course, Shakespeare is mocking Polonius in his advice to Laertes, meaning it's very, be cautious, don't be true to yourself, really, don't speak or act in any way that will, raise any questions. It's all very careful and prudent for someone whose life in the palace was filled with this these kind of machinations. So I think there's certainly a mocking going on here. I would say then, like, do the opposite of what Polonius says to Laertes, meaning I think for me, and when I say that we have five core values at Yeshiva University, truth, life, infinite human worth, compassion, and redemption to work to redeem the world. So when we explore the truth, that's in our Torah and our Mada. And our study and our research and our time in the library and in the Beit Midrash. You know, we're seeking the truth. And when we seek the infinite worth of ourselves, of our own special skills and talents in Torah Adam, we're using education in order to help us find ourselves. For education is not just a window into the world. It's a light unto your soul. And you learn about yourself by reading widely and by exploring. You learn your skills and your talents. You learn what makes you you. And you learn how to best move forward in your life as an Eved Hashem, as a servant of someone who wishes to fulfill God's great gift of life to achieve one's destiny. So I am a proponent of reading and studying and working widely. I'm also a proponent of the action. I think one thing I've learned you saying as president, I'll tell you this very candidly, you are what you do. I say this in direct contrast to Hamlet's ruminations. And I'm not sure if I, when I've read Hamlet, if I've always seen myself in him. I wouldn't say that. I do see contrasts. You know, when the rabbis say that Lo HaMedrash, Iker Ela HaMaisa, it's not the study, it's the action, which is the essential. I think it's essential not just because the actions help move history forward, which is, of course, our mandate and, you know, the Jewish mission. But actions also define you and who you are. Long before cognitive behavioral therapy, we believed in the power of actions. And, the Sefer HaChinuch, quoting the Rambam, off the Rambam, who, of course, was very much influenced by Aristotle, that the heart follows one's actions. So I think as president of YU, I've seen this a lot, that it's not you know, the ruminations and the meditations, those are all great, but you need to make decisions, and your actions need to reflect your values. And the way that, if you're successful, then those actions will reinforce your values, reinforce your sense of self, and enable one to develop further. That's what we did. You mentioned at the beginning of this about coronavirus. We led with our values, meaning we've known what our five core values are. And every decision we made, from closing the school to open, to how we opened the school, all of the messages of the president and the communications that we've sent out over this year, all of the decisions, both in a major way and the details as well, we've been working according to our value system, our five core Torah values. And that has given us the confidence to move forward. Because even when we don't know exactly what's going to lie ahead, we're in totally unscripted terrain. We believe that we have the compass and we knew how to get there. Wherever it's going to be, we have the compass because our values are our compass. And that's core. And that's core to who we are.
Thank you so much. Personally, I could say I've learned so much from this conversation. I know our listeners will too. Learning that is purposeful, that we could pay forward. As an educator, you know, as a teacher within the YU system, I'm so grateful to what you've been doing and to this leading with values. We can feel it. We can feel it, you know, in the temperature scans and the app checks and in the distancing with our students. They're so grateful for everything that you're doing. Thank you so much. I hope this is the beginning of many conversations.
Absolutely, Shana.
Thank you for listening to Twice Blessed, a project of the Yeshiva University Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought. This show is produced by Uri Westrich and Sam Gelman. Information about this episode, including the audio credits and reading recommendations, is available in the show notes. If this conversation left you feeling blessed, please subscribe to Twice Blessed on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and consider leaving a positive review, sharing it with friends, and following us on social media. Thanks for listening.